Hello, this is The Link Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. Want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out, www.linuxshow.com, for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
Hello, this is The Linux Show for Tuesday, February 18th, 2003. I'm Kevin Hill. Jeff's taking the week off, and so today will just be me, Russ Pavlicek, Arnie Flores, and hopefully Doc Searles will be calling in. How's everybody doing tonight?
Well, doing great here, Kevin. It's been kind of cool over here in the LA area. Perfect earthquake weather, I think.
What's cool, Arnie?
Cool is in the evenings. At night, it goes down into the high 40s or low 50s.
Oh, good golly.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Not cold. I didn't say cold.
Yeah, we almost got up to 40 today. Looks like we missed out on most of the good snow.
Yeah, well...
Well, we sent it all the way over to Russ, I think.
That's it. I'm currently sitting here in the middle of approximately 24 inches. A little to the west of us, there are reports that they got up to 40 inches inside some of the more mountainous areas. But by and large, it seems that the D.C. area, D.C. Baltimore area, got hit with anywhere from 18 to about 26 or 28 inches, which around here means total and complete paralysis. And that's what we're enjoying here. You see lots of four-wheel drive vehicles and not a whole lot else tooling around. But in keeping with the weather around here, it actually did get up to almost 40 degrees today, which meant that the thaw has begun. So we're going to have
mess.
So we're going to have flooding like no one's business for the next 2 or 3 days.
Lots of slush.
Yeah, and then of course for me the final thrill was stumbling across the state's drought website that they have, and they still, lo and behold, they still say that we're suffering from a drought, and I have no idea how the heck this is happening. We're already at something like 3 times the annual snowfall for the year,
it probably has to melt before it counts.
Excuse me?
It probably has to melt before it counts.
Yeah, something like that. But my golly, we're having a great time.
So who's got an interesting Linux story of the week? Who wants to start off?
Go ahead, Russ.
Oh, okay. I don't need to thaw, so I guess I'm okay here. a couple interesting things. One, if you notice on the webpage, there's a link to DVD Fairy Tale, which is a column I did last month for InfoWorld. The only reason why I have that up today is because I got an interesting little email, which I didn't have a chance to discuss on the air, from someone supposedly representing the DVD Copy Control Association, which, frankly, I had never heard of, but I'll take their word for it. That's who they are. But the bottom line to this letter was they were trying to correct my facts. And the DVD Fairy Tale column, for those of you who didn't see it, basically talks about good old DVD John there and how he was acquitted, at least in his first trial over in Norway. And these wonderful people went on to tell me that he had done the DECSS code illegally, that it was not there for the viewing of DVDs, but for cracking the encryption and for pirating. And, and then they go on to say, and for me, this really seals things. They went on to say that Linux DVD owners do have options, and the options that they came up with was the NetStream 2000 DVD decoder, which apparently has not worked with any Linux kernel in the last 2.5 years, as far as I can tell. InterVideo's LinDVD software, which is available only to manufacturers, and I've yet to find a single one that is actually selling it. And the IBM ThinkPad T22 apparently came with, I think it was the LinDVD software. And unfortunately, of course, the T22 is also out of production. So considering that these were the only three instances that they could come up with where a Linux user could legally watch a DVD, and none of them are available, as far as I can tell, inside any sort of current form, that just holds up my point that this whole nonsense has done more to hurt Linux DVD use than anything else. It has very little to do with copy protection.
It has nothing to do with copy protection.
Yeah, well,
the DVD CCA is the outfit that was instrumental in the East Coast DVD case from what's the name of the Hacker Journal?
2600.
2600. Yeah, the 2600 case. They were the complainant, one of the plaintiffs in that case, and so. These guys are, you know, just like they're just corporate hacks. You know, they don't know. They wouldn't know a DVD decoder if they saw it. Obviously.
Yeah, it was an interesting letter, and it was interesting in that it was rather clearly holding forth a corporate line, as it were, and had and apparently was hoping that I was totally clueless on the matter.
Yeah, you know, you're just a newspaper person who doesn't know anything about computers, right?
Yeah, and in fact, I asked them to clarify a few points, and they never bothered to email me back, including the fact, you know, I called out the fact that they mentioned that the work that was done illegally, and I said, oh, do you mean to say then that the Norway courts got it wrong for some reason? That somehow they ignored the fact that he did it illegally and didn't choose to respond to that.
Well, I mean, you know, they are appealing it, and which is an interesting thing in and of itself, because in Norway apparently there is no law against double jeopardy, and you know, this was a criminal case in the United States. Had Jan Johansson been tried and charged and tried in the United States, he would now be completely free of the charges, because once charged and acquitted, you cannot be recharged.
Right. So I mean,
nor can there be an appeal.
So they're appealing, but they're certainly not trying to.
I don't think they're very appealing.
my second story for the night, over at InfoWorld. A publication which I have some affiliation. There is a piece called Linux Talent Search, and you can find the URL on the Linux Show webpage. The Linux Talent Search piece by Eve Epstein is probably worth reading for anyone out there who's trying to find a job as a Linux administrator, quite frankly. Because it does talk about, in some detail, the some of the frustrations that businesses are having trying to both locate Linux talent and trying to find people who not only know Linux but actually know how to be an administrator in a business. And I think sometimes some people kind of miss that point in the Linux community, that there is something to be said about professionalism and all that when you're administering systems in a business. And by that I mean not professionalism in terms of code or something of the sort, but in terms of certain types of conduct and so forth. So if you're looking for a job in that area, check this out. In particular, it'll help you understand what some of these people who are trying to hire are looking for. And so hopefully you can better adjust presentation so that they see what they want to see. But I found it a very interesting sort of article in that regard, which is, you know, it's kind of interesting too. Inside the community, we talk about Linux jobs, and it seems like whenever I'm at a conference in the last year or so, at least, and we talk about Linux jobs, there are a lot of people out there who seem to immediately come around and say, "Oh, do you have one? You know, I'm looking for one. I'm looking for another administrator job or something like this." So it's kind of interesting to read something where employers are saying we can't find enough people. So I think a lot of it is that we got to bring the groups together, so to speak. And I think this article is pretty interesting in that regard.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Because there's a lot of people with Linux talent out there, and I'm sure there's people looking for Linux talent, and that would be a good business model from my standpoint.
Yeah, so I think that will be an interesting thing to watch. Another one of my stories is this piece called "Open Source in Mexico Part 2" from our own infamous Robin Miller over at OSDN. And he talks a little bit about some of the things going on in Mexico from the conference that he was at. But the interesting thing that I found with this particular piece is the notion that apparently many Mexicans are under the impression that if some other country is doing something, it's got to be better than what they're doing. It's kind of the reverse of the not invented here syndrome, which I'm so used to in corporate America. But it's more like, hey, if it's not invented here, that's good. and so inside some ways that actually kind of works against open source, because there's actually, you know, relatively well-known people like Miguel out there from Zimian and so forth. And it appears that part of the culture might tend to look away from them and look more towards a solution like Microsoft or something else, figuring that if some other country is doing it, it must be better. And that's a very strange sort of concept, but enlightening nonetheless. Outside of that, there's one other interesting little announcement that I got just before showtime, which I want to share. And that is a press release from Central Command, which is sounds like the military is coming into this. But Central Command has announced that Lindows, which we all know, is now going to have the opportunity to have an antivirus installed on it. The Central Command Virus Safe, using best of breed Vexaira antivirus for Linux workstations by Central Command. At first I saw this and I thought, oh, you know, antivirus for Linux in particular. The ones that I've seen thus far have been mostly on the servers to disinfect email that is targeting Windows users using those servers. But this is something different. This is to disinfect your client PC. And it occurs to me, at least...
Your Linux client?
Yes, in particular your Windows client. And this to me seems quite strange, because most of the things that at least standard antivirus software historically fights are not, or at least have not been, issues under Linux, and probably won't be for quite some time, as far as I can tell.
Unfortunately, Windows makes the users root.
Yes, that's true.
And so, you know, and I just don't see how any virus software is going to be able to stop an arbitrary... Excuse me. An arbitrary script from running in one of the 30 or so scripting languages.
Although, as far as I know, I don't think anyone has created an email program stupid enough to actually execute something that's in an email.
Yeah, that's kind of the bottom line, you know, that the real problems that we see inside Linux now on the whole generally are not the things that you use an antivirus program to deal with. Is more along the line of patching holes, of using the equivalent of Mandrake Update or whatever you have for your
deprecation.
Yeah, to bring on the latest security changes. But the traditional antivirus, frankly, as far as I can tell, there isn't a whole lot for it to do now, and I think it's going to be sitting awfully idle for an awfully long time. But an interesting point from this press release is that it, let me see if I can find a line. It says, Lindows.com has addressed the number one software request for its desktop Linux operating system at the low price of just $29 annually. So somehow, I guess by virtue of the fact that they are working with former Windows users, they're getting apparently a large number of requests for this service, despite the fact that, as far as I can tell, there isn't much for it to do.
Well, it should be very easy to implement.
You know, Russ, this is interesting because, as you very well know, perceptions are everything.
That's it.
And the Windows users used to having Norton antivirus and McAfee antivirus and this plethora of, broad stage of antivirus products available. And you know that the pony-haired boss isn't going to go for Linux if he can't put his favorite antivirus software on it.
Yeah.
And maybe this is an answer. It's like give them a useless a near useless gizmo to add to their thing just to make them feel comfortable.
And that may well be the sum of it, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out because, quite frankly, I find it fascinating, for lack of a better way of putting it. It is definitely different and quite unique, I must say, inside the Linux desktop environment. So that is. Oh, and the other thing I would just say is that. We've done a lot of talking on this program about stuff happening at Walmart.com and so forth. I was given a hint that there's going to be an interesting announcement tomorrow with regard to yet another thing that is going to be occurring with Linux and Walmart.com. So keep your ears peeled and your eyes peeled to your favorite Linux news source tomorrow. It might be of interest to folks.
Is this the licorice?
It could be.
Well, it's already been announced, and the licorice machines are available on the Walmart site.
Well, so much for their press release. But, check it out, guys. There's some interesting things going on. Okay, with that, I think I'm done.
Okay, so Arnie, what's your stories for the week?
Okay, well, let's see. I've got three good ones. First of all, FilmGIMP. Which is the video or the film version of GIMP, of the graphics program, has been adopted by yet another major film graphics company, Computer Cafe. And this is in addition to Hammerhead Productions and Sony Pictures Imageworks, which are already using, and DreamWorks, and ILM. Let's see, who else? adopting FilmGIMP as their tool of choice. And, of course, all the major movie graphics studios are already using Linux. And so it's no surprise that FilmGIMP is being the tool of choice. But apparently they're choosing it not because it runs on Linux, but because it really, really is quite good. And this is... It seems like supercomputers are really, really a Linux lockdown right now. And FilmGIMP is I guess, stable enough and everything, you know, to, you know, let's see, they list some of the movies that they did. The Panic Room, Hulk, Imposter, The One, Armageddon, Flubber, Battlefield Earth, etc., Spy Kids 2. And this is considerable. This is a considerable success for Linux.
Too bad none of the people working on these movies will be able to watch the DVDs when they're done.
Yeah, you know the DVDs. Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's a good idea. Good point. Yeah, this was reported in NewsForge, and the link should be up on the Linux Show site. The other two stories I have are concerning IBM, and one is really kind of interesting, and that is IBM has licensed the Qtopia software suite and will be using it to put together a design kit, a Palm Top PDA design kit, which is in the works and will be released, due next month, for a cost of about $1,000, including blueprints, software necessary to help individuals and companies create different personal PDA systems, PDAs, and also software development and everything else for $1,000. It sounds like it includes hardware. It comes from IBM Microelectronics and a few partners, and it's due in March. That is really cool. I'm really, really happy with my Zorus, which runs on the Qtopia. And, of course, if it runs on Qtopia, it's also going to run on open Palm Top platforms, too.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that catches on. I also saw that Motorola was pushing Linux in their phones.
Yeah, and there's another article in eWeek this week. I don't have it in front of me, but there was another one that talking about Linux Java. The Java-based phones are helping Linux out, too, which is kind of neat. And it seems like Linux has got the embedded market going their way, and which is not surprising given its capabilities. Also, this is a feather in the cap of Trolltech in Norway, who licenses Qtopia, Qtopia, and Qt, of course, being the base for the KDE desktop.
Yep.
And this, of course, gives KDE capability compatibility with the Linux Palm Tops, and that dovetails very nicely with the promotions of the Linux desktop recently, and we see the pieces starting to put together, and Microsoft must be very worried. I got an email. Didn't you get a copy of this email to Russ today from one of our listeners? This is Russ. I follow up to my email 2 weeks ago about radio ad Microsoft on how it's cheaper. Here it is. He found it in print, and here's the quote. Ask for Microsoft Office XP on your new PC. It costs less. And there's this caveat at the bottom of the ad. An independent survey of 100 computer retailers in January 2003 indicate that Microsoft Office XP Professional costs less when loaded on a new PC than when purchased off the shelf as full package product.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my.
Oh, my gosh. That is... Oh, my gosh. That is terrible.
At least it's honest.
It's terrible, but it's honest.
Good, I mean, golly. You know, lobotomies are cheaper that way too when you get them built in.
Oh man, that is wild.
That's a wild one. I mean, you know, I want to see that ad. I mean, I'm going to be thumbing through my computer magazines this week, real heavy. The last article is also concerning IBM, and this is a John Sarsgaard, Vice President of Linux Sales Program at IBM. And he was interviewed by a CRN magazine, which is one of my favorite computer magazines these days, because they seem to have a little bit of clue. What's interesting here is they're asking him about Linux and how Linux fits in with IBM's strategies. And, of course, his answer is that Linux is not a passing fancy. But one of the things that's interesting here is that they claim they have 300 full-time developers working on the operating system now, IBM does. And he says, people ask me, why are we investing these resources in an operating system that we don't even own? And this is his answer. We want to promote keeping Linux consistent and to see that the best enhancements and updates go into the Linux kernel, which means that we're going to be probably seeing some more stuff from IBM. But what another interesting part here is they are... IBM said Monday it is launching a new web-based tool that partners can use to calculate potential return on investment if they build up a dedicated Linux practice. Solution providers input data about the size of their company, their annual revenue, and other factors, and the program will estimate how much they might need to invest before expanding their business to offer Linux solutions. Interesting. Hmm. The new tool is the latest addition to IBM's Leadership Edge for Linux program, which offers solution providers access to Linux experts, white papers, and other resources. That's really cool.
Very cool.
I wonder just how they calculate that.
Smoke and mirrors, maybe. I don't know. It's nice. It's a nice idea, though. Now, if they could put up the TCO calculator. But maybe that's part of it.
Could be.
Another thing is that he also said that across IBM, which is a pretty big company, 7,000 employees have some Linux expertise. On his team, some 200 IBM salespeople are using a specialized Linux knowledge to drive sales. They're really, this is something we knew, what, two or three years ago when they first, IBM first jumped headfirst into the pool. But they seem to really be still walking the walk.
But where's the Linux laptops?
Well, you know, I'll give them a pass on that until that no one has them yet.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that the Linux world, that question came up a lot, and the standard response that I got from just about everyone was that, you know, we have to be able to move enough of them. And when you're talking about these big players, enough becomes, you know, truckloads per week. And... the volumes aren't quite there yet, but for crying out loud, I can't see it's going to be a whole lot longer.
Well, look at desktops. Look at the desktop PC. The desktop PC is a fairly easy thing to reconfigure. And if Linux doesn't work real well on a particular desktop, it's really easy to swap out the video card with another one that works better, or the modem that works better. You know, and inexpensive to do it because the commodities. The components are so commoditized that there's really no cost involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on a laptop, that's not true, where everything is, like, pretty much designed to work together, dovetail nicely together. And all of a sudden, now you've got this thing that maybe, possibly, doesn't work real well with Linux. And the lead time on these designs has got to be longer. You know, like a year or two more.
Well, it seems like most things on most laptops work except for modems.
Video.
Actually,
video. I mean, what I mean by video is not the VGA video. I'm talking about, you know, like DVD video and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Gee, I can't figure out why that would be the case.
They have proprietary video cards.
Yeah, and the other thing I found is that on laptops, occasionally, still run into sound issues. A lot of the time, it seems to me that it's more a case of not detecting the sound chip properly during install, more than it is anything. But
that's just an installation issue.
Yeah, but I still see it fairly frequently.
Well, when the ALSA sound drivers get merged into the kernel, kernel will see those disappear, because that's what I've been using. And I'll tell you right now, they are. I'm using a cutting edge Intel motherboard with the latest and greatest sound and technology and the latest and greatest onboard video. Now the onboard video works. The onboard sound works. Unfortunately, the onboard video doesn't support DVD, and unfortunately, the onboard, I'm having trouble with the onboard network interface card. Mm. It doesn't. I'm having trouble with that. It's gigabyte LAN, and it doesn't work real well. Mm. In fact, I can't get it to work at all right now. But I had it would go to a cutting edge kernel. I mean, not cutting edge, but 2.4.20. And I had to use the beta test version of X-Free in order to get the video to work. And it won't support all the modes. But it works fine for what I want. And that's, I think, the problem with the laptops.
Doc, are you there?
Not there.
We are dockless.
Looks like we lost Doc.
Yeah.
Oh well, but as for my story of the week, GNOME 2.2 is out, which among other things gives us good anti-aliased fonts and everything, as well as better theming support and supposedly a lot more simplified preferences handling. A lot of things that were kind of lost in between, whether it was part of the Window Manager or GNOME or whatever control panel, has been simplified in one places to a lot of extent. And another thing that I noticed is kind of ironic is that 2.2 is out already, whereas no distribution has really fully integrated GNOME 2.0 yet. And
wow.
Symbian, which is kind of pushing the whole thing, still doesn't have a 2.0 desktop release out.
Really?
Debian?
Symbian.
Oh, Symbian, oh, yeah.
That's wild.
So which makes me wonder about, again, about the old issue of the speed at which updates are coming out and just trying to put together a working system when you always seem to be running behind and trying to keep up with things. And then you tie that in with Red Hat now only offering support for 18 months on their releases, that this could potentially turn off a lot of people.
SUSE was doing that too. And in fact, that's why the main reason why I switched from SUSE to Debian. And part of the problem was the fact that it was really difficult to do an update of the version, the distribution version with SUSE without breaking a lot of stuff. And of course, in Debian, I it's like almost brainless. And there's always some minor glitches, but I usually not too many. And for the minor releases between the dot releases, Debian just works just beautifully. For the major releases, not so well, but it's still better than the dot releases on SUSE, which tend to be. Now maybe they're better now, and I'm sure they are. I mean, this is something we've got to get better about this. But you know what? My experience with upgrading major releases in Windows is nothing short of horrible. I mean, Windows does not like to be upgraded, especially with all the spyware and everything, all the hooks inside of it.
That's true, but they do at least tend to give you, I think it's, 5 years before they actually abandon a release.
Yeah.
Or it's one thing to always have a cutting edge, but to actually stop providing updates after just a year and a half, I think, is a bit extreme.
Yeah.
Well, I think 3 years is a good compromise. My mother-in-law still runs Windows 95 OS R2, which is, she doesn't need the USB, so there you go. And her machine runs pretty well on Pentium 2, and it's not cutting edge, but it flies fairly well. And it's all she needs.
That's it. That's all that most people want.
Well, now I could put Linux on her on a machine, but for her. But I just soon not have to do the network administration.
Okay. Well, I guess at this point we'll take a break. So go ahead, kick back, listen to the music, and we'll be back with segment two in a couple minutes. So hang on.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
we're back. Once again, this is the Linux Show for Tuesday, February 18th, 2003. And I'd like to remind everyone, if you're in a band or have some music that you still own the copyright to and you'd like to hear it on the Linux Show, feel free to send email to staff@thelinuxshow.com and let us know where we can download it, and we'll play it for our break music. Now for segment two, Russ, take it away.
All righty. And folks that were tuned in last week, we talked about gaming software that was being done out in the far future with Chris DeBona. And this week we have a major change of speed here as we talk about the Open for Business project, and that's coming right now. So tonight we have David Jones and Andy Zanefsky. Hello, fellas.
Hi.
And let's see now. On the web page, people can see the short bio and write-up. David is a software developer and believer in the economic viability of open-source software, hooray, hooray, and related business models. And it also mentions that David is from Utah but currently lives in a motorhome so that he can stay with his family as he travels for business. Now, that's an interesting way to get around, sir.
Yeah, it's kind of nice.
And Andy Zanefsky, also a founder of the Open for Business project, and let's see, holds IBM certification in WebSphere. That must be quite useful. And bringing Open for Business to a level of its commercial alternatives. So what exactly is Open for Business?
Well, I guess the short description of it is that it is a framework and a set of application components, as well as applications built on them, for general enterprise automation, be that accounting or inventory and warehouse management or e-commerce or customer management or whatever the case may be. And we're pretty much going after all of those areas. So I guess the goal is to put this software together that can be used and maintained by a whole bunch of different small or large groups, and in that way can compete with some of the bigger commercial packages and provide an alternative that's a little bit more friendly on the budget and a lot easier to change.
Could you speak more directly into your phone, please?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, we're getting some notes out on IRC that it's getting a little difficult to hear sometimes. That does happen, unfortunately.
Okay, sure.
So you have this framework and this structure. Now, exactly what is the project composed of? Is it like discrete components that are doing various things? Is it something that's more monolithic in nature? Can you describe it a little bit more?
Sure. I guess on the framework level, we have a number of tools to make the development of the applications easier. And we talked about kind of how, whether it's organized as something more monolithic or as discrete components, and that's an important part of the framework, that it enables these very loosely coupled components to work together in the larger application.
Mm.
And we have various, it's based on a number of the J2EE standards. So it runs in a Java application server, although there are only certain pieces of the application server that we use. For instance, we do not use Entity Enterprise Java Beans. We have a more dynamic alternative to that. And some other things like what we call a service engine, which is the very piece that allows us to create services, kind of like a web service, but meant to be used inside the application as well as possibly exposed to other applications.
Hmm.
So there's the framework level. I guess another piece of the framework that I should mention is the workflow engine that allows kind of automated back-end processes that are can go back and forth between human activities and automated activities. And then we have kind of a little miniature language in XML that allows you to tie components together using the other tools in the framework. Just kind of simple instructions for doing things with those. So that's pretty much the framework.
Well, we also have an entity engine, which it's a relational database mapping tool. Dave, you want to go into more detail about that?
I guess I could say a quick word about that. It's a little bit different than the common approach of using an object relational mapping tool. We have a number of XML files that describe the structure of the data, and then a dynamic API with common operations that behave differently based on how the data structure is defined. So the SQL is generated real time and sent over the database for running. So that kind of simplifies things by removing a layer. We just go directly from our services to the entity engine rather than having an object layer in between that also has to be maintained.
What is your website?
Website is at www.osbiz.org, and OSBiz is O-S-B-I-Z.
.org, because the Google engine finds another site that's a Linux-based site, ofb.biz, and so that's apparently a different thing.
Yeah, if you on Google, I've noticed if you search for Open for Business, it's kind of a generic name, so you get a lot of other stuff.
Well, you just got to get people to link to you.
That's right.
Push you up on the standings.
Yeah.
Now I see out on your webpage you have a column that says, you know, open source projects used.
Uh-huh.
It talks about FreeMarker and WS Publisher and Bean Shell and goes down the list. There's a long list there. Now, are all of these projects part of the engine structure here, or are they things that that you talk to, or what's the story here?
As much as possible, we've tried to use existing open source pieces and not try and reinvent things and take on maintaining more than we do. And there are an incredible number of really useful tools, the Jakarta, Apache Jakarta tools, and lots of similar things like those ones that you were reading from the top of the list on our website. And those are anything from, like, scripting languages or templating languages or tools for dealing with XML or transactions or whatever it may be. So there's a lot that the framework calls into as well as makes available to you. So if you want to write a component in JavaScript instead of Java, you can do that and plug it in as a service. And the same goes with Python using Jython, or Tickle using Jekyll, or all sorts of different alternatives that are available.
Well, that's very interesting. How did you get started in doing all this, by the way? I mean, where did the notion of putting together this whole framework and all this, where did that come from?
Well, Andy and I came from two different directions. You want to start, Andy, on this?
Yeah, I was doing commercial e-commerce consulting. Actually, I was working for a consulting company here in the park, and found that there was a lot of empty space available. They had the smaller retailers who purchased little soft cart Miva type sites, and then you had the very large guys who could afford WebSphere and BEA Commerce Suite and Blue Martini, but there was nothing for the middleman. So My objective was to go out and try to either find a project, join in, or start my own that was to create an e-commerce system for this middle-sized business. David had another idea at the same time.
I actually worked for a couple of startups that were trying to implement something like this using either internally developed software or like combination of kind of a best of breed approaches from different packages. And one of them lasted about a year, failed to get a second round of venture capital funding. So I went to another one, and it only lasted about 6 months after I got there. So after that, I decided the best way to get something like this going would probably be an open source project. And it allows kind of a very low overhead operation that can still do a lot, and we get an incredible amount of feedback from it. So it's worked out really well.
So I started a project, and David started a project, and after a couple of emails, actually out of the blue one day, David emailed me and said, hey, maybe we should talk about joining together and instead of having two separate projects. So that's exactly what we did.
Who is Angle Park Technologies?
That is it's a hosting company for Open for Business Hosting Solutions.
Ah, because there's a demonstration site on your website.
Yes.
Over on the right side is this demo site, and there's two little sites that you can go and see. One is an e-commerce site, and the other one is what you call the management console. And I find the management console intriguing. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about that? That's kind of looks interesting.
Okay. I guess the management console is really all of the back-end administrative tools that a business would use to manage various things. And it's kind of split up into different areas based on the part of the business being managed, everything from party management, which would be people and organizations, to the catalog, all of the products and services available, orders, marketing efforts and other marketing data, work efforts, or that's kind of the general term we use for issues and tasks and projects and calendars and all of that sort of thing. And then there's also pretty much empty right now, but planned areas for accounting and content management. I like
the demonstration page, which says in this case is the tab that's highlighted when you go there is the order tab. It says party, marketing, catalog, facility, order, accounting, work effort, content, and web tools. But the order tab is the one that's highlighted, and it's got, I would presume, to be near real time order totals and order statistics and stuff for your little demonstration e-commerce site. Is that?
That is correct. Actually, all the dummy orders that flow through the e-commerce site, they do trickle back down to the order manager, where you can actually play around and view and actually demo how you would process an order to the
Well, it's really interesting. Is you got the summary statistics, so year to date, week to date, month to date, etc. This is well thought out.
Yeah, the order management is pretty neat. That's a piece that Andy's worked on quite a lot, and just recently we moved over from more manual order processing to workflow based order processing. So there's a default workflow in there, but you can modify it to include any internal approval steps or preparatory steps for shipping or whatever needs to happen before the order is fulfilled. And that's a piece that we plan to use, or the workflow engine, that is, in a number of other places in those applications.
What is this running on?
The flavor of Red Hat Linux, actually.
On what type of hardware?
It's an IBM E-Series.
That's a rented box, isn't it, Andy?
It is a rented box.
I see my IP address in the visits log on Party.
Indeed.
Yeah, after they visit.
You can actually track users real time and actually monitor what they're doing on the site.
Cool.
What additional things do you expect to see in the future, coming additions to the software or expansions?
Well, the two main areas, the first one would probably be accounting, an area that, as you see, we already have a tab for, but we don't have anything filled in yet, so that would probably counting and content are going to be our two next focuses.
Right now we're working on a lot of the tools for content management, and we have a lot of the data structure already in place for tracking metadata and structure of content in the database. And you can put the actual content in the database or in a file or at any URL location. But and then the same thing is kind of true with accounting as well. We've done a lot of work on structuring the data already according to various accounting standards out there, like the OMG GL standard, and there was a proposed OMG ARAP standard. So we've tried to structure things so that it will work well with those standards.
Who right now is using using this product, or what type of organizations?
I guess the most common organizations are consulting groups, especially small consulting groups that have clients that need software like this, and they can offer them a lot more through Open for Business than they could through commercial alternatives, and also open up more money in their clients since they don't have to pay for licensing for their services. So it's very popular in consulting organizations. I guess as far as end-user companies go, we see a lot of people that are upgrading. I should preface this with the strongest component right now is the e-commerce engine and the back-end to support an e-commerce site. So companies that are a little bit too big for the smaller shopping cart packages that want something bigger but maybe don't want to jump all the way up to a million or multi-million dollar package like Blue Martini, or go into the heavy customization needed for something like WebLogic Commerce. So it provides kind of a middle ground for those that's a lot less expensive. So they're good. That seems to be one of the most major groups. And then we're also starting to get to the point where it's mature enough that people are using it for other reasons. We have a company that's using it for managing home building projects and the budgets and estimates and so forth associated with that. And there are other companies looking at using it for managing their warehouses and inventory, as well as accounting and other things. Often these are companies that don't have a lot of infrastructure in place already and are looking to get into something without a huge investment. I guess coming from the other direction, we've also had some people that are using a major e-commerce package or something, and the licensing is just eating them up, sometimes even including revenue sharing, and so they want to switch to something that's more budget-friendly and still at the same time be very easy to customize and change to do whatever they need to.
I notice your site is also your Open for Business site is also running on your own engine.
The osbiz.org site is actually just static HTML right now, but the demo site, of course, is on our own engine. And in the future, as we get more content management pieces in place, we will start using those. We're also planning on transitioning over from SourceForge to our own tools for task management, issue management, bugs and features requested, and that sort of thing as well. So, yeah, that is something that is important to us.
Is that going to be part of your product line then?
Yes, it will.
Those tools?
Uh-huh.
And you're making money on this because it's open source. You're making money on this by the consulting or the support side of things.
That's correct, yeah. So we're doing consulting contracts, and it's very easy to sell it when you walk into someone and say, hey, instead of paying $200,000 or $1 million for that other package, you can, in addition to the consulting required to implement it, you can knock out that licensing and have plenty of money left over to pay for consulting services.
Which is really the major cost.
Right. That's often the case, yeah.
I mean, Microsoft is continually talking about the cost of support in supporting things, and of course their claim is that they're cheaper because they're support costs are cheaper. But
uh-huh.
when you come right down to it, support costs are fairly static, the same across any platform.
And that's often the case, yeah. We have actually been able to do, some of the sites that we've worked on have gone up with the hardware, licensed software needed, like databases and so forth, and everything for less than it would have costed for the licensing of some competing packages.
You're licensing Postgres, MySQL, MySQL, and Hypersonic SQL. And is your database technology, SAP DB, is your database technology open enough that you could, like, for instance, put Oracle or whatever?
Yes, it works with Oracle as well. I think somebody's tested it with Informix, several Microsoft SQL Server even. So our entity engine layer is very, very flexible. It's cross database supportive. Yes.
Yeah, there was a question out on IRC here, asking specifically on why you would choose to use multiple database backends. And the comment from the listener out there says it seems they would either standardize on one or possibly include some others like Firebird.
Oh, we actually do have support for Firebird as well. I don't think that's on our website right now. Actually, that's just listing the databases that we currently support that are open source.
Yes.
You don't actually have to use all of them at the same time. You can use any of them. You can pick and choose.
That's a nice feature, certainly, because certainly upscale, customers who are upscale on your market would certainly want something more robust or bigger, more efficient, and might want, if they're already using Oracle, to dovetail your work with their existing products already.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is a nice flexibility point for that. So we can run in a Java database, and it's really easy to deploy, or something like Oracle running on a 64 CPU Sunbox and handle a very large amount of traffic.
There's another question out on IRC that says, how have you found using JBoss's J2EE as a foundation framework?
JBoss is a nice package, and there are kind of some pluses and minuses with it. Distribution, we just have Tomcat and a little transaction manager called Pyrex, which isn't very good for deployment, but it's very easy to configure. So that's what distributions for deployment, JBoss is a good option, especially among the open source options. And if you are familiar with configuring it, it's not too bad. If you're coming into it fresh, it takes a little bit of time to get started with it. But it is a very good package and has a lot of useful tools in it.
Have you had many problems in putting together this whole project? Have there been anything that seems like it would be a showstopper at the time, or things you've had to work around?
You mean on a technical level, or a business or marketing level?
Oh,
or
take it either way, whatever
way.
You've found.
I guess from a technical level, there have been a lot of times where we've run into something, and it just seemed completely unworkable at the time. We had to throw out the work we did and go with a different solution. An example of that is originally we were using Entity EJBs for our persistence and a code generator to make that easier.
Oof.
And after we got our initial data model in place, we had over 1 million lines of code generated out of that.
Wow.
So that became really difficult to manage in a hurry, and came up with the alternative of using the Entity engine. So we're down to about 10,000 to 15,000 lines of XML to describe the entities and their relationships, and then everything else is dynamic on top of that. And I guess on a business level, of course, it's always difficult to keep a steady stream of clients, and then of course maintaining the open source project while trying to serve the needs of clients at the same time. So it's a little bit of a juggling act, but having an open source project to use as marketing leverage has been really very helpful, We haven't really had to do a whole lot of looking around for people to work with. They usually find us.
And once they're customers customers of you, that many are more than willing to help with ideas and or even some of the contributions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been really surprised about that, actually. A lot of our customers are very, very willing to have things go back into the open source projects. When we're working with them, they generally encourage us to find a way to make it generic so that it can go into the project, off and on their dime. And then after we're done working with them, we still continue to keep in contact and get feedback from them. So, yes, that's worked out very well.
This is one of the complaints I've heard quite often about open source is that, well, I can't expect my clients to be writing code.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the answer, of course, is they don't have to, but tell me how that has worked out for you, because that's really a very common complaint to people who don't understand the open source community and how the community and the customers are the one and the same. And how has that worked out for you?
Well, in a lot of cases, what's happened is that there's kind of been a two-layer community, a layer of service providers and a layer of end-user companies. And so, of course, the end-user companies are the ones that have the real business needs and that drive a lot of what goes on. And they either have an internal IT organization or they work with a partner company to do the development and maintenance for their software. And usually we will, like Andy and I, we will work with either an internal IT group or a separate services group. So occasionally we will work directly with an end-user client that does not have a whole lot of technical skill on site. But generally we do actually work with other engineers and help them get going because there is often quite a bit of technical skill needed to keep these things running and to customize them and keep it filling the needs of the business as time goes on.
But you're having codes being submitted by the users. That's
the
point.
We are actually quite a bit, yeah. Especially on the framework level. We've had a lot of code submitted.
On the framework level? This is at the low level.
Exactly right. It seems like with the applications, we hear about a lot of people writing specific applications, but that's kind of the point of their business. And
that
so
really gets contributed back.
Yeah, exactly. So it rarely gets contributed back. Their purpose is to create a piece of proprietary software based on the open source piece, which is fine. And I suppose it would be nice if people would put more effort into making generic components as part of their stuff and putting it back into the project. But, of course, that costs extra money. And even if they don't do that, we still generally get a lot of good feedback and some contributions from these types of groups. I guess a good example of that is Atlassian. They have a product called Jira that is built using some of the components from Open for Business, but it is a commercial project, and they've had a lot of good success with it and fed a lot of feedback back to us. So that's worked very well.
Quite cool. Another question out on IRC asking if it's easy for website designers to develop under it.
Well, just recently we've started migrating. We used to be using a whole bunch of JSPs, and honestly, I think they were a little bit rough on the web designers. Our new approach is we're removing a lot of the logic from the pages, and we're using a templating engine called FreeMarker, which will makes the pages so much cleaner. They're so much smaller. Mostly, it's just presentation now. Very little logic. So it will be a lot more designer friendly.
And as far as deployment goes, if you download the distribution, all it takes is unarchiving the application and running it, and it will use a Java database at that point. For deployment, it's nice to have someone a little bit more technical come in and help you configure a database and get an app server set up a little bit more formally, maybe running through Apache or something. get SSL set up, a lot of different things that need to be set up for a live site. But as far as customization goes, yeah, we're especially with the upcoming stuff, it should be much easier for web designers to work with.
Quite cool. Okay, since we're kind of run past the hour here, but what final takeaway bits would you have our audience know about Open for Business?
Well, I'd say if you find it interesting, download it and give it a try. There is just getting it running on your machine or going to our demo site. It's easy to browse around and look at some of the things that are in there. And if you have any questions, feel free to email us. We have a few very active lists, and we try to keep up to date on those questions, usually within, anywhere from a few minutes to a day, we try and get them answered. So.
The demo is pretty much a full feature. You can totally maneuver through the e-commerce engine. The back office is pretty much view only, but you can get a really good idea of what's involved and what it has to offer. If downloading it is, but downloading it should be quite simple. All you need is Java installed on your machine.
Well, that's great. Well, I'd like to thank David Jones and Andy Zaneski. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us in this segment, and I will hand it back to Kevin.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming. And on that note, we've wrapped up another show for the week, so come back next week. And like I said, if you are in a band that has some music you'd like to hear on the show, remember to drop us some email at staff@thelinuxshow. And for everybody here, thanks a lot for coming, and we'll see you next week.
So you need an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? Well, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, because my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a guy from mine to dine out to Fonkin and Hattie, I do suit your, he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to daddy. My heart belongs to daddy.